From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, Think and Grow Rich. Here's what's happening. The top U.S. commander in the Middle East has announced in Baghdad that 2,200 U.S. troops will withdraw from Iraq by the end of this month. That's good news. The Marine General Frank McKenzie made the announcement alongside an Iraqi Minister of Defense as a sign that the troop reduction decision was made in consultation with the government of Iraq. 3,000 troops will remain. President Donald Trump has admitted that he knew weeks before the first confirmed U.S. coronavirus death that the virus was dangerous, airborne, as we stated, way before anybody else did, and highly contagious and more deadlier than the flu. And then he repeatedly played it down publicly, according to legendary journalist Bob Woodward in his new book, Rage. And a lot of people today are calling for the president's resignation because of that. A day after all but canceling Halloween, Los Angeles County health officials walked back a ban on trick-or-treating during the pandemic. Trick-or-treating is not banned now. It's just extremely inadvisable, according to the Los Angeles County Public Health Department. I wonder what that's going to happen with all the kids all around the country. Howard Bloom's with us, the author of The Global Brain. Howard, I want to talk with you about the COVID situation. First of all, this story about the president going back as far as February that this was more deadlier than he would say. A lot of people are calling for his resignation over that.
They're calling for it, but there is good reason. As of today, we've had more coronavirus deaths in the United States than England, France, Italy, Germany, and Spain combined. And in fact, we've had more deaths than all of Africa and Asia combined, which means we've had more deaths than two entire continents. If we had followed South Korea's path, which the president didn't, and had done testing and isolation early, we would have had 2,644 deaths as of today. Instead, we've had 191,000, and in less than 10 days, we're going to have 200,000. And it's not too late. With a crash testing program, we could still stop the virus in its tracks. But the only battle is not with the virus. There's also a battle between the left and the right. And it's a battle of perceptions. Conspiracy theorists are promoting the belief that the COVID epidemic is simultaneously a hoax and the deadliest act of biological warfare in history. One source of these conspiracy theories is a slick, high-budget video from something that calls itself the COVID 911 insurgency. It's the kind of high-cost production that could easily have been bankrolled by Russia. The COVID 911 insurgency video claims that the coronavirus pandemic has been conducted by what it calls the cruelest conspiracy in the history of the world, by Democrats and liberals like Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, George Soros, Oprah Winfrey, and Tom Hanks. The goal is supposedly to make massive profits and to control the world. According to sources like this, the coronavirus has been invented to protect these Democrats' sex with children in underground tunnels while drinking blood and worshiping Satan. Then there's the widespread theory that Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates were roommates at Cornell and have concocted the coronavirus scare to get you and me injected with a vaccine that will contain tiny microchips. Those microchips will allow Gates to track all of your movements and mine and will make Fauci a fortune. Fauci, this conspiracy theory goes, was the first president of the drug company Moderna, a company that will produce the new vaccine and a company that will make billions. Plus, the microchips in the vaccine will supposedly be the mark of the beast that the Bible warns us against. Every single so-called fact in these rumors is false. Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci were never roommates. They couldn't have been. When Fauci entered college, Gates was 4 years old and 2,500.
Well, he was a genius, Howard. He was a genius kid.
Yeah, these were terrific kids, yes, but he was busy working in the computer club at his high school and being allowed to use the massive computer at the University of Washington.
Well, let me stop you for a second, though. The president said today that he did what he did because he wanted to stop mass panic. What do you think about that?
He did want to stop mass panic. He was very ill-informed about how to handle this virus. He should have brought in testing really early. He could have prevented 198,000 deaths.
Not all of them. Not
yes.
all of them.
Oh, yes, because we would have had 2,034 deaths. if we had followed the Korean example, which is staggering.
It is starting to slow down now, but we shall see. But what a day this has been. I've never seen anything like today, folks, on television. This was an unbelievable day in terms of attacking the president, whether you support him or not. It was. It's not good for the country. It really isn't. There's no question the coronavirus pandemic has forced many Americans into financial hardship, and a new survey paints a clearer picture of the extent of the struggles in the United States and for the largest cities. At least half of all households in those cities, 53% in New York City, 56% in Los Angeles, 50% in Chicago, 63% in Houston, face serious financial situations. Charles Koppes, author of America's Financial Reckoning Day, with us. Charles, when are we going to dig ourselves out of this hole?
Well, good evening, George. We're living in troubled times with this pandemic, the unemployment, the coming election, and just what you've said there. I don't know how it's going to take. Actually, bear markets can take years. And let's face it, we're really facing that situation. The real economy is always the jobs. And according to the BLS, 750,000 jobs were added last month. About 45% were part-time, according to they were census takers for the government. So that kind of distorts things right now. But since April, only 70% of part-time jobs have recovered, while only 50% of full-time jobs. That means millions of unemployed people. And we know evictions are coming up, or they've extended a moratorium, I guess, to the end of the year. But this is going to be the real issue going forward. People vote generally their wallets,
yeah.
Economy. And so, one economist said it's not a V-shaped recovery we're having. It's a K-shape, where the wealthy class are going up and the poor keep getting poorer. So evidence of that would be the NASDAQ index last week. It's remarkable, George. Just they had the fastest 10% drop and recovery in just 3 days.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. But, you know, we've had a lot of shows. Charles canceled one of our major events in Everett, Washington, was called off because they wouldn't allow enough people in the theater, and it was almost sold out. Sports venues, same thing. I mean, eventually we're going to have to open up again, aren't we?
Well, I think we should go the way of Sweden, quite honest.
And just open up.
Yeah, just because they didn't wear masks, they let the herd immunity or whatever. But I think they got it right. People like to talk about that. I would say, as far as your listeners right now, I like what Warren Buffett's doing. He's hedging in gold mining shares. That's made a lot of news, and I think that's a pretty good hedge going forward, the ultimate safe haven for the next 6 months or so. But let's hope we get through this, George. These are tough times.
Charles Bork, America's Financial Reckoning Day. Teachers, start preparing now for a class full of Liams and Olivias. The Social Security Administration has released its official top 10 most popular baby names of 2019. They're not all that different from 2018. Liam and Olivia came out on top as the most popular male and female names so far. How about that? Well, it began on September 1st, and it's continuing throughout the fall. More than 2,400 active-duty airmen in space operations and space systems operations transferred into the U.S. Space Force in public and private ceremonies across the globe. How important is a space force? In a moment, Brandon Weikert, his new book called Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Brandon Weikert with us, geopolitical analyst, manages the Weikert Report, World News Done Right, holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Science from DePaul University, an MA in Statecraft and National Security Affairs from the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., a recovering congressional staffer. Weikert travels the country briefing audiences on concepts related to space warfare, alternative energy, biotech, quantum computing, nanotechnology, and other technologies as well. His book is called Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. Very important book, by the way, Brandon. Thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for having me. And it was a very nice introduction. I'm glad to be here.
How important is a space force? It's amazing. Now, first of all, was it President Donald Trump who gets credit for this, or was this in the planning stage before he even got elected?
No, he should get credit for it. They've talked about this at the Pentagon. I remember reading about this. You know, I've met Donald Rumsfeld many times, spoke to him in 2014 or 15, and he was knew that I was interested in space. And he was telling me about how, you know, when he was in the Secretary of Defense before 9/11, one of his big pushes was to try to get Space Force going, but they couldn't get it out of the gate. And there was no support for it from either party. So this was something that President Trump really glommed onto, and, you know, he really ran with it. It was something that sort of someone put the bug in his ear. I know some people from the campaign came out to some of my lectures, literally were taking pictures of my slides where I talked about space dominance and the need for an independent space force. And three or four days later, the president's using those exact same terms. And I know that he has really hired people for space policy, both on the military side and the civilian side, who really have a commitment to space in a way that we really haven't seen since probably JFK. Trump's really interested in it. He's really, really gung-ho about it. And so I think he should get the credit. Of course, the political environment being the way it is, you know, where half the country thinks Orange Man bad, who knows? But no, my personal opinion is, yes, he should get the credit for it.
What happens to the Space Force, Brandon, if he's not reelected?
Well, and I just had an article in Real Clear Politics a few days ago about this. And basically, because Space Force is an act of Congress, the next president can't just outright kill it. What the next president can do, though, and remember, Space Force is the smallest branch of the now six branches.
Right. I just mentioned just a few thousand people signed up for it already.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. And so it's the smallest branch, and really personnel is policy. So what the next administration can do, and there are many military officers I've met, in the particularly of the Air Force side, who really are skeptical about Space Force and feel that it's going to infringe on their budget. So what the next president, if Trump does lose, or even if the president after Trump, the next president can assign people to run Space Force who will be inimical to Space Force's mission and will do everything it can to undercut the program from within. So they can't outright kill it, but they can certainly do things to sort of deprioritize and put people in charge who aren't going to make it this great branch that it should be. You know, one of my mentors, Dr. Owens, loves to say that, you know, the 19th century was sea power. Well, the 20th century was all about air power, and I say the 21st century is going to have to be about space power.
I had got an email in from one of our listeners right before you came on tonight, and they said, isn't it a shame we have to militarize space? And I said, if we don't, the Russians and Chinese will.
Yeah, and that's a common misconception, because my argument in the book, in chapter three, The Case for Space, I go through the history briefly of sort of human development of space and human activity in space, and whether we're talking about the formation of the rocket or we're talking about the launch of Sputnik, these were military endeavors, or rather they didn't become fully realized as technology in the real world until the military really pushed these things into the next level. So in my book, I argue that space has always been militarized. It was in the context of the Cold War that we created NASA. NASA may be a civilian program, but it had very strategic military objectives, which was to beat the Soviets in the space race. And we now today rely heavily on satellites for not just civilian functions, but our military is entirely dependent on satellite constellations for power projection. And so we've already militarized space a long time ago. The question is, are we going to weaponize it? And as I argue in the book, if you look at in the form of dual-use technologies, I think Russia and China have already been weaponizing space in the form of co-orbital satellites, for instance, which are small satellites that are launched up and can tailgate our satellites. And if need be, the Russians or Chinese could order those space stalkers, those small co-orbital satellites with grappling claws, to latch onto our satellites and literally push them out of their orbit to render our forces on land, at sea, in the air, or within cyberspace, deaf, dumb, and blind.
We've talked a lot on this program, Brandon, about an EMP attack, electromagnetic pulse attack, a nuke detonated high atop the atmosphere. which would render our power system useless and literally wipe us out. I think the Russians and Chinese, and we probably do too, have nukes in space.
Well, it's possible. I think it's certainly that was a fear in the Cold War with the Soviets, and that is certainly a possibility. I think something to watch out for in terms of electromagnetic pulse is also the North Koreans and Iranians.
Yes,
the
absolutely.
Chinese and the Russians, you know, they can be crazy, but I think ultimately they have very obtainable in their eyes objectives. So going all the way to an EMP strike, I think, would sort of be a last-ditch effort on their part. But with North Korea, especially North Korea, with its nuclear capabilities where it's at, and they have a robust nuclear capability now, and they've been launching satellites since 2012 into orbit that remain in orbit, by the way. They're in these weird orbits around the Earth, a lot of polar orbits. But James Woolsey, who I know, he wrote several articles over the last 10 years warning how North Korea could be seeding orbits with low-grade electromagnetic pulse weapons, which could be basically used to kind of like a Bond villain, hold the world hostage. Either you give up South Korea or do what I want, or I'm going to detonate these things and send you back to the 19th century and see how much you Americans like living as North Koreans do.
Exactly. And they'll say, if it even happens to us, we don't care.
That's right.
You know.
That's right, because, I mean, look how they're living now. And another thing, when I worked on the Hill, they were still dealing with the after effects of the EMP Commission, which, you know, was a huge study, which took years to complete. And basically, they found that the United States cannot survive such an attack. That, I mean, in the worst case scenario, given how dependent we are on these electrical systems, an EMP strike above the continental United States over the course of 2 to 3 years, in the worst case scenario, could wipe out anywhere of 80% to 90% of the population, not just directly, but from after effects of riots and food shortages and disease proliferation and all of the horrible things. And, you know, it's a real doomsday scenario for a society like ours, which has become so dependent on advanced technology for our most basic operations.
In 2013, the BBC did a report on what would happen if all the satellites just went out.
Right.
And and this was 7 years ago. This would be a disaster then. It would be worse today. Just about everything is run by, controlled by satellites.
Everything.
Television, cell phones, banking, everything.
Everything. I saw a report by CSIS, which is a think tank in Washington, and I think this was from a couple years ago. They said something like 89% of America's systems, of American life, relies on satellites. You know, as I talk about in the book, I can't go on to Facebook without my signals passing through space. I can't use my card at a gas station to pay for gas without those signals passing through space.
That's right.
You know, our military, we talk a lot about what's going on in the South China Sea right now with China, you know, building up their naval capacity, possibly starting a war with us. Well,
China wants Taiwan, Brandon. You know that.
Of course they do. Of course they, yes, and or going after Taiwan. And the one thing you have to remember is the Navy relies on a satellite network known as MUOS to basically coordinate its deployment. And any fight with China would be predominantly a naval fight. And the Chinese know about the MUOS constellation, and you can rest assured, or maybe not rest assured, but be panicked that the Chinese have developed capabilities to deny access, the U.S. Navy access to that satellite
That's
network
right.
that could render our Navy basically useless in a fight. And they would be supposedly the tip of the spear in a fight against China. That spear would be seriously blunted. And, you know, earlier this week, China surprised the world by launching a reusable spacecraft, a mini space shuttle that successfully orbited the planet and returned to Earth yesterday. Upon its return, though, it released a smaller object into orbit that NORAD is now tracking. I believe this is another form of those space stalkers I spoke about earlier, those small co-orbital satellites that can ram our larger satellites and knock them out of orbit. The Russians have been deploying systems similar to that for years now, for intercepting covert transmissions between our satellites, and also potentially for ramming those satellites. And so it appears to me that China and Russia both, for their own geostrategic reasons, are ramping up their counter space capabilities to, whenever they're ready, deny the United States its ability to coordinate, mass, and attack, or rather defend, say, Eastern Europe from a Russian attack or Taiwan from a Chinese attack.
Okay, stay with us, Brandon. We're going to come back and take more of your incredible story here, winning space. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. We'll let you jump in next hour as we take phone calls then with Brandon Reichert as we talk about his work, Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. His website is theweichertreport.com. Don't worry about spelling. We got it linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Brandon Reichert with us. We're talking about his work, Winning Space. And where do people get your book, Brandon?
Oh, you can get it on any online retailer, Amazon. It's coming out September 15th, but it's available for pre-order now.
Now, the Space Force itself, if we had 10,000 members, they're not all going to be up at space at one time. What do we need them for?
Well, basically, right now, no member of Space Force or any other branch, unless they're in NASA, is going to be physically in space. Inevitably, right now, they're doing all the remote sort of, monitoring of satellites and whatnot and ground stations. But inevitably, as I argue in the book, we're going to need to adapt a strategy for actually having, they haven't quite decided on the term yet, either spacers or space troopers. We're going to need to develop a strategy for putting actual Space Force members in orbit to man military space stations. The Defense Innovation Unit over at the Pentagon has already begun putting feelers out for the last year and a half for proposals for military space stations, which would be used to sort of house personnel as well as to allow for sort of tripwires in space, put them near sensitive systems and make it harder for China or Russia to knock out our satellites. It's sort of like NATO, where we put our forces right in the kind of crosshairs of Russia, or back in the day, the Soviet Union, with the logic being that they're going to be a little less likely, unless there's a real crisis, to take a shot at our people. Right now, it's a low-cost endeavor, relatively speaking, for China or Russia to target unmanned systems in orbit. But if you put military space stations, command centers up in orbit, and you create sort of swarms of satellites, mm-hmm, commanded by those space stations, you'll have line of sight will be much better than it is from Earth to space. It'll be line of sight from the military space station to the potential satellite swarms. You'll have C2 functions that'll be better. And so that's inevitably where we want to get to, I think, is having actual personnel in space, as well as being able to deploy personnel from space, drop them into a combat zone. These are things that this was a sustained program that the Marine Corps and Special Forces were in 2002 very interested in, and now I think they're starting to look back into that program again using a space plane from similar to what Branson is using with the Virgin Galactic, weaponizing it and using it to deploy kind of hunter-killer teams on Special Forces missions, sort of to avoid some of the legal issues that come with overflight rights as they currently exist, dealing with the war on terror, for instance. And so these are things that are in the very early stages of discussion right now at a doctrinal level for Space Force, and I think that's where we're going to go. But in terms of where we are now, Space Force really is just manning sort of terminals at military stations in Colorado and California, mm-hmm, and they're doing everything remotely. But eventually, we're going to need the infrastructure to be able to support actual military operations with military personnel in space.
Brandon, take us through a hypothetical space war. What's actually happening?
So it would be not as sexy as it appears in either Star Trek or Star Wars, unfortunately, but it would be very lethal in terms of the ramifications for us here on Earth. Basically, one day we could wake up and...
No cell service, for example.
No cell service, no ability to call 911, no ability to... nothing. I mean, your anything electronic that requires... a signal will be disrupted. It will, at the very least, be laggy, but it would probably be totally disrupted because the system would become overloaded. I have friends in the Navy who say, yeah, but we have undersea cables that we could offload a lot of the operations onto, and I just think that's a laughable concept. Mm-hmm. First of all, they can nowhere near handle the load of a modern society like ours, and second of all, everyone in the world, all the intelligence agencies, know where those lines are. In the Cold War, both we and the Russians were experts at tapping in and cutting those lines. The Chinese have the same capability with submersibles, so that's not a really good backup plan. We can't rely too much on drones because they're not as effective as satellites with handling the load long term. So we would be deaf, dumb, and blind as a society. They could use lasers to blind satellites temporarily. They could use traditional anti-satellite killer vehicles. Basically, think of a missile launched up from the Earth, tracks a satellite in orbit, knocks it out, creates a debris field, of course, and that could cause a lot of secondary and third tier damage to nearby satellites. It's the Kessler syndrome. Basically, it creates a ricochet of debris that knocks out everything in orbit, and then you've got a real catastrophe on your hands. Or they could use what I was talking about earlier, which were the space stalkers, the co-orbital satellites, to physically push our satellites out of orbit. And I actually think that is the most likely method of attack, because I think that has the least chance for unintended damage. The whole thing about a space Pearl Harbor, as I talk about in the book, is for Russia or China, they're going to want to minimize secondary damage. They're not going to necessarily want to take out satellites that belong to countries other than the United States and our allies.
How do they know?
Well, we have an international registry. So the UN maintains an international registry of all satellites in orbit.
There's like 2,000 satellites up there, right?
There is a national registry, then the FAA also, federal government also has registries, and basically it is not that difficult for a foreign rival to figure out where our systems are. About 5 or 6 years ago, the Russians took great joy in publishing photos they took of very sensitive, what were at the time newer surveillance satellites that we had just put up, and they found them within no time. It's not difficult for a dedicated enemy with the kind of capabilities that Russia, China, or ourselves have to be able to track and sort of figure out what our satellites are doing. Even when we don't publish exactly what their mission is, it's pretty obvious. You can determine from the orbit and sort of what they're focused on, what exactly the satellite mission set is and how sensitive or important it is. Satellites in geosynchronous orbit, which is the furthest orbit away from Earth, those are where our most sensitive satellites and most vulnerable satellites are. Those are where the early missile warning satellites are. That's where a lot of the MUOS constellation I talked about for the Navy, it's where the wideband global SATCOM constellation is for the Army. You've got surveillance satellites up there, a lot of things that can be very bad for us if we lost are up there. And by the way, in 2013, the Chinese, under the guise of a scientific mission, they began testing systems that can actually reach into geosynchronous orbit and obviously threaten our systems there, and the Russians have the same capability.
They even blew up one of theirs, and we were concerned about the parts hitting the ISS and everything else.
That's absolutely. Well, you're talking about the 2007 Chinese ASAT test, which I identify as being year zero. 2007 is year zero in the new space race.
Uh-huh.
That was the year that the Chinese, out of the blue, did this very dangerous, very sloppy test where they launched an anti-satellite missile up at one of their derelict weather satellites, blew it up, and created, and it's still in orbit today, it created the largest debris cluster in the history of human.
And you don't need a big piece to damage something,
no.
Right?
Think of the film, you're right, and think of the film Gravity with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney.
Right.
The whole story of that film was that the Russians woke up one day and decided to randomly test an ASAT weapon, which accidentally created this cascade of destruction, which knocked out the entire global satellite constellations, and of course created all kinds of problems for the characters in that movie. But the point is that is based on the Kessler syndrome. That is a real risk that we're running today, and which is why, and the Russians and Chinese are aware of that, and I think particularly the Russians, if they were going to do a surprise attack, would probably prefer a co-orbital satellite attack. The Chinese, with their 2007 ASAT attack, though, were sending a signal to the Americans that A, they can do this, and B, if need be, they'll risk taking out the world's satellites, because right now there's an imbalance in our ability to rely on satellites. Basically, we rely disproportionately on satellites more so than our enemies do. Now, that could change over the next decade, especially as China is becoming more advanced. But until the next decade, there's really going to be an imbalance in the way that we rely on satellites relative to how our enemies do.
Is it an act of war, do you think, to take out a satellite?
I would argue that it is. There is some gray area, especially we're talking about things like a laser attack, which temporarily blinds a satellite. My understanding is basically a laser fired at the optical gear of a satellite that temporarily shuts down a satellite, doesn't necessarily permanently destroy it. It makes attribution more difficult, and the satellite basically shuts down and kind of opens its solar energy cells up to the sun to recharge, and you basically have to hope that the ground operators can reconnect with it. And in the meantime, that creates a gap in our surveillance, communications, early missile warning systems, which would give the Chinese or the Russians a window of opportunities to exploit and surge their forces into a contested part of the Earth. And that's sort of the basis of a counter space attack, render the Americans blind. So it's hard to be able, in some cases, to be able to attribute the attack, and it would be difficult for us to say it's an act of war. But yes, technically, I believe it is an act of war, yes.
But who do you blame? How do you blame? What if the Chinese say, we didn't do it, the Russians did, and then vice versa?
Absolutely, and that's the key. We do have the ability, though, to basically backtrace and figure out. It would just take time. A laser attack would be very hard for us to determine, but we would figure it out. And we can especially figure it out because the Chinese have been extremely hot and heavy in laser technology for counter space operations development. And so we have ways. It's just like with cyber attacks. There's a myth out there that we have no ability to know exactly where a cyber attack comes from, which I have friends that work in the NSA, and they laugh whenever they hear that in the news. We have the ability to attribute these things. It just takes a little bit of time, but we can figure it out. It's not impossible. Something like a co-orbital satellite attack, I think, would be more effective against our systems, but of course that makes attribution a bit easier for us, and an ASAT test as well should at least theoretically be easier for us because there's only a handful of countries that have this capability, and really two, China and Russia, that have a purpose and reason for doing such an attack.
I learned after 9 years in the Navy, Brandon, that our big deterrent was our nuclear submarine systems.
Yeah.
Those were the ones. I mean, we had them parked right off the coasts of those countries, and we could hit them in a matter of minutes.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And, of course, the downside is, though, they're so dependent on satellites.
Satellites,
today.
Absolutely.
And, so the concern, we also have a problem with spoofing. And so that's where basically a third party can come in and can hijack the signal from satellite to the downlink signal, from the satellite to, in this case, say, the submarine, and can either send it off course. We see a lot of attempts of spoofing of the American Global Positioning System satellite network. We see this a lot, and Russia and China both have been very heavily invested. So you could have an instance, for example, where the Chinese can track our subs. We can track theirs, of course, but the Chinese, this is a little known fact, but they can track our subs. And so the Chinese could track a U.S., nuclear submarine coming into their part of the world, and they could spoof signals coming down to the sub for navigation and send it, running ashore, or send it crashing into a reef and sink it without it ever getting close to the area of operations. And so this is a threat that we have to deal with, and we are not really quite there yet with addressing it. We're starting to, but we've seen a lot of outages that I've often wondered, outages in the GPS system over the last few years that I've often wondered are actually the Air Force attempting to mitigate what are spoofing attempts from our rivals. And they've never admitted in public, but that's just some suspicion that I've had on certain issues.
And I believe our subs have been told, if you do not hear from us, that's us being the United States of the mainland, at a certain given times, you launch.
Yeah, that used to be the hair trigger. Yeah, that used to be how it is. That was during the Cold War. I'm not exactly certain with the Navy on. I know there are redundancies now built in.
But
I don't trust the redundancy because everything ultimately goes back to the satellites. And if an enemy is manipulating the satellites or has deprived us of satellites, you know, it causes a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And even if nobody launches, well, that also then makes our nuclear deterrent not very effective, because what happens if the Chinese, for instance, know that our nuclear deterrent has been rendered ineffective? Well, that's going to make them more likely to just go roughshod on launching their own systems, knowing that, hey, the Americans are unlikely to be able to respond, and then the balance of terror is lost.
Brandon, why can't we just all get together and be good with each other and have a great life? Why can't they do that?
It's human nature. I think it was Adam Smith who observed human nature is flawed but fixed. And that question has kind of been the basis of my academic career. And that's why I study international relations and foreign policy, because I'm fascinated by the fact that we live in a world of abundance. I mean, that was the best time, even with COVID. Now is the best time to be alive. And yet we're at each other's throats. And it's just
crazy. I mean, I would try to build the best defense system in the planet, in the world, with the hopes of never having to use it.
That's right. Well, that's the Reagan model. That's the model that I prefer. And that's why I support not only protecting our satellites, but I support the Space Force eventually being able to actually deploy Reagan's dream of the Strategic Defense Initiative, because not just Russia and China, but Iran and North Korea, the nuclear rogue states, are a problem, and we can't rely on anyone else to protect us from those nuclear arming threats. And the best deterrence would be putting up an actual viable space-based missile defense system that we could say to Pyongyang and Tehran, you know what? You can build all the nukes you want, but guess what? They're not going to ever leave the Earth, because if they do, we're going to knock them out of the sky before they ever
leave. Right, they're coming right down crashing on you, folks.
Right. That's right. Absolutely. And that's, and that to me would, as Reagan observed when he announced Star Wars, that would fundamentally change the paradigm on the Earth. I mean, there would be no way our enemy, it might force our enemies to be more compliant. I hope that would be the case. Or it could force them into this, craze of trying to get their own, new age weapon system. But that would still buy us time, to enjoy a relative amount of peace. And in the process, who knows, maybe we can work a new deal out. Who knows? But, I'm with you on that. I wish that we could live in that world. But I think actually, preparing for war would be the best way to avert wars, George Washington.
Absolutely. Brandon, we're going to come back and take some phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.